You guys, I have a huge surprise today.
What?
We have a really special guest.
Who?
I'm not going to tell you. You're going to have to wait.
We're going to have to, like, wait how long?
I mean, like, wait until, like, he appears, but who do you think it's going to be?
I don't know.
Is there going to be fanfare?
It's Tom Brady.
Is there going to be Are we going to have a sponsor? Like, maybe Me Undies shows up finally?
It's the Me Undies man.
Coming?
Harry's Razors with Tom Brady.
Having secretly known, because at NSA, of course, I read all of Shane's emails. I really think this is Rational Security's breakthrough into, like, real legitimacy.
It's a celebrity? Is Kim Kardashian coming?
You know what? It's a Rational Security celebrity.
It is.
Aww.
Wow.
Security celebrity.
Let's find out. Hello and welcome to Rational Security, the Guess Who's Coming to Dinner edition. I am Shane Harris of the Wall Street Journal. I'm here getting ready for a very special guest. We're in the Jungle Studio with my friends Ben Wittes, Tamara Kaufman Wittes, and Susan Hennessy. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hey. Who is it? Who is it?
You're
is
on
it?
The edge of your seats.
I want to know.
Today on the podcast, we are going to have Senator Chris Coons of Delaware.
Awesome.
Whoa.
He is our...
Like a real elected official?
An actual elected official. I don't know. Maybe somebody here was elected to, like, dog catcher or their condo board.
Never.
Ever.
I always ran for student government and lost.
Yeah, me too. I never got elected.
I never got elected to things.
Yeah, so this is our first actual elected official.
Because we've had other guests. We've had, like, Jonathan Rauch a bunch of times.
Yeah.
Come on.
This is our first congressional guest, for sure.
I'm Jonathan, with all due respect, he's not legit because he's never gotten one statewide.
Yeah, we're being fully endorsed by a U.S. senator. Well, maybe he wouldn't go that far.
Yes, everything we've ever said in the past or future.
Apologies in advance as he gets ready to come on the show.
Maybe for the last time.
But actually, why don't we go ahead and get right to it? Joining us by phone is Senator Chris Coons. Senator Coons, welcome to Rational Security. Well, you are our first lawmaker, our first senator. You're our first, most special guest that we've had so far. So we're really glad that you could join us here today. I wanted to start out by asking you a question about an essay that you wrote recently in Democracy, where you laid out your hope for areas where there could be a bipartisan approach to foreign policy, and specifically on ideas like development aid, working to shore up fragile states, possibly working towards a new legal underpinning for the fight against terrorism. You wrote that essay before the inauguration, and I'm curious now, 2.5 weeks into the new administration, are you still hopeful about those views, or how have things changed from your perspective?
Well, Shane, thanks for a chance to be on. And you're right, the Democracy article that I published suggesting 5 different areas where we might find bipartisan progress in foreign policy and national security was initially drafted before the election. So I had to do some quick revisions. And at that time, there really was not enough known about what President-elect Trump's actual views on foreign policy would prove out to be. In the course of his campaign, he had certainly said a number of concerning or even alarming things about Vladimir Putin and Russia, about our NATO allies, about the nuclear umbrella, and his view of South Korea and Japan. I could give you a dozen others. And it just wasn't known yet what direction he might take. He's been president now more than 2 weeks, and I'll say it's been a roller coaster ride. He has conducted some diplomacy by Twitter and phone call that has created real distance or challenges with some of our allies. And has, I think, emboldened some of our adversaries. So it's been an uncertain 2 weeks. But I still remain optimistic about several of these areas where I think there is an existing record of bipartisanship on the Foreign Relations Committee, and where I think there is a commonality of interest between senators that in some ways may have been strengthened or sharpened by ways in which President Trump has started on a course that is in real tension with the positions that leaders in foreign policy and national security have taken over several administrations, Republican and Democrat. So now that we know that Secretary Mattis is the Secretary of Defense and Secretary Tillerson is the Secretary of State, I think we have some reason to be optimistic that they will steer back towards the sort of center point of what has been a decades-long consensus on internationalism and engagement in the world, We don't yet know who will be USAID administrator or assistant secretary for Africa. So one of the points I made about U.S.-Africa policy and development assistance, I don't think we can really assess yet. But I do think we have to be optimistic. Look, I couldn't get on a 625 train and commute down to Washington every day from Delaware if I weren't optimistic. So we have to choose to believe that the forces in the Senate that pull us towards each other will ultimately be stronger than the forces that push us apart.
So Ben Wittes here. Can I ask you to amplify on an aspect of that answer? You you said that there are bipartisan relationships in the Senate that have been strengthened by the process of reacting to some of the peculiarities of the last 2 weeks. And I expect by that you mean also the several months before that in the transition. But I'm interested in what are the areas where you've seen sort of Republicans, more reinforced in their interest in the themes that you're talking about because of the way the administration has talked and behaved.
Well, I'll give you a few quick examples, if I might. Senator McCain, a Republican of Arizona, and Senator Reid, Democrat of Rhode Island, the chair and ranking on Armed Services, picked up the phone and called Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull to reassure him about our support for our alliance with Australia, our gratitude for their long and sustained and close partnership with us in counterterrorism, national security, and regional leadership after President Trump had a difficult, even a disastrous call with the Australian Prime Minister. Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican of South Carolina, joined Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, a Democrat of Rhode Island, in announcing a joint investigation into Russia's cyber attack on our election. They're using a subcommittee of the Judiciary Committee, on which I serve, to conduct an appropriately sort of detailed and formal review into Russian actions that were undermining our democracy and our democratic process in the last election. Senator Cory Gardner of Colorado joined with me in introducing a bill to create a new Senate Select Committee on Cybersecurity, which would deal with some of the ways in which cybersecurity is stovepiped among and between at least five different full committees of the Senate and create a new permanent Select Committee to deal with these issues going forward. So that's just a few examples. As I think I've referenced before in this article and elsewhere, my first 4 years as a senator, I chaired the Africa subcommittee. Johnny Isaacson was my ranking, a Republican senator from Georgia. And we worked very well together and managed to have a whole series of hearings, introduce legislation, work together on issues like a AGOA reauthorization. And I think the current chair and ranking, Senator Flake of Arizona, Senator Booker of New Jersey, with support from Senator Isaacson and myself, we'll also continue to do strong bipartisan work in U.S.-Africa relations, from diplomacy to development to security issues.
Senator Coons, this is Tamara Wittes. I'm struck by the first example that you cited because I know that you've spent a good bit of time in your years in the Senate so far going on CODELs, traveling abroad, visiting the troops, doing site visits to development projects. And I wonder how much you think the Senate, Democrats and Republicans, can compensate for diplomatic missteps by the executive branch. What's the appropriate role for senators there?
Well, Tamara, you're right in that in my first few years, I thought it was important to go on bipartisan CODELs. My very first trip overseas as a senator was with Senator Bob Corker, as well as Senators Manchin and Sanders, to Pakistan, Afghanistan, to Jordan, and to Israel. And my relationship with Senator Corker, who's chair of foreign relations, is rooted in that travel experience together, the extent to which he really impressed me with his preparation, his thoroughness. And I think that is one of the roles that the founders imagined for the Senate, that we would have long terms, that we would develop interpersonal relationships, that we would become in some ways a bulwark against an overreaching executive. And so I think the relationships that many of us have built with each other that I've also built with Senator McCain and Senator Graham in joining bipartisan CODELs with them to the Middle East, would actually strengthen our ability to act in concert, to assert the priority of longstanding understandings and relationships. So, for example, very soon after the election, Senator McCain and I and a number of other senators and congressmen went to Halifax in Nova Scotia to Canada to a security conference. And I was up all night the first night meeting with Ukrainians, with leaders from Baltic states, with leaders from countries alarmed and concerned about the things President Trump had said in the course of the election. So I do think it is possible for senators in a bipartisan way to reassure our vital allies, to reassure our partners in NATO, our partners who are on the front line against Russian aggression like the Ukrainians, our partners in the Pacific, the Australians or South Koreans or Japanese. It is really striking just how much work President Trump has created for us in this department in just 2 weeks. I'll remind you, I think it was literally his first day after the election. He really sort of stuck a cattle prod into our relationship with the People's Republic of China by suggesting, after taking a call from the president of Taiwan, that he might overturn, you know, 40 years of U.S.-China policy. And I think he hasn't slowed down since. It is entirely possible that one consequence of having Donald Trump as president is that we will see a renewed relevance, a renewed vigor in the United States Senate. So perhaps at the same time that he's working to make America great again, we, in coming together to oppose some of his initiatives, will help make Congress work again or make Congress great again.
Senator Coons, this is Susan Hennessy. So sort of one thing that we've talked about a little bit on rational security is some of the ways in which traditional foreign policy sort of surprises ordinary Americans, right? So it strikes some people as sort of silly that we would worry about what pronoun to use whenever we talk about the president of Taiwan or what our relationship with Saudi Arabia might look like, right? Sort of communicating that degree of nuance and how complex this area is. I think that's one of the things that's been a struggle as sort of President Trump has adopted really dramatic sort of breaks with not just conservative or liberal policies, but sort of core American understanding about what our foreign policy interests look like. Whenever you think about communicating either to your own constituents or just talking to the public about foreign policy in general, has your strategy changed? Sort of how do you think through those issues?
Well, Susan, you ask a good question about whether the sophistication, the complexity of communication in diplomatic circles easily translates to a campaign environment and with a president who is unprecedented in his use of 140 character missives to light up the world. We are in a somewhat different environment. I have to recognize that President Trump is president in no small part because a few hundred thousand voters across several states were convinced that his boldness, his bluntness, his willingness to break from traditions and norms offered change, change that they viewed as advancing their interests. So we can't just dismiss the idea that the American people understood something more profound about our role in the world and their yearning for change. It is striking, particularly in the world of diplomacy, national security, global affairs, that Donald Trump's opponent in the campaign, Hillary Clinton, was arguably one of the most prepared candidates ever to be a leader on the world stage. She had studied and engaged in diplomacy literally for decades. She was a tireless and active and, I think, effective Secretary of State. She could have told you off the top of her head the names of heads of state of a majority of the world and probably told you lengthy stories about recent visits, current issues and concerns, dynamics within the country. I suspect Donald Trump would have struggled to name more than a dozen heads of state from around the world. So it is striking how big the gap was in their skills, their craft, their grasp of these issues. And it is somewhat depressing to recognize that millions of American voters nonetheless chose someone to be our president who whose grasp of foreign policy and grasp of the nuances of diplomacy is quite different. The reality, though, is that, you know, we face a difficult, complex, and divided world. The American people, through a free, fair, and open election, are entitled to their choice. And those of us now in the Senate have to follow, I think, our role, as the founders envisioned it, in acting somewhat as a speed bump, or in some cases, a block, to some of the less well-considered initiatives of this president. The travel ban, some would call it a Muslim ban, that was one of his very first executive orders, I think, is sort of plaintiff's exhibit A in the case against having an inexperienced president sort of thrashing about like a bull in a china shop in world affairs. And fortunately, we have a district court, and now likely, I think, a circuit court in the state of Washington and in the western region of our country that will put some check on President Trump's actions. The responses from Iraq, from Yemen, from other vital Muslim and Arab allies suggest that this travel ban overreached, was not well vetted, and will lead us into places of real tension and discord with some of our vital allies in the fight against ISIS. So I think we've already got a record in just 2 weeks from this president of how he might mobilize and engage folks in the Senate, how he will hopefully be successfully constrained by the judicial branch, and what the path forward may look like. What we don't know is how he will respond, what he will do next, if his executive orders, if his nominees or his legislative initiatives are thwarted by either judges or senators.
And can I just jump in, because I know Ben wants to ask you a question, but on that, this is Shane, on that one point, how concerned are you that if he is blocked, if the courts rule against him, that he might simply try to ignore the orders? I mean, it's a bit of a nightmare hypothetical that we would have a constitutional crisis where the president would simply choose to ignore the judicial branch. But are you concerned about that? Is that something that you're realistically contemplating could come to pass?
Of course, I think we should all be concerned about that. There is an historical antecedent for it. As you know, President Jackson famously challenged the Supreme Court and said, "Where is their army?" That was, you know, more than 160 years ago, I think. And it is my hope and expectation that President Trump and leaders of the executive branch will respect and closely follow judicial orders. But he has already engaged in a troubling series of tweets and remarks and speeches where he has challenged or undermined or mocked the district court judge in the Western District of Washington, the Ninth Circuit panel. And this is the first time that his power as president has been challenged or checked by a court. I don't know what his trajectory might be. President Obama, you know, famously himself a professor of constitutional law, issued a whole series of fairly broad and far-reaching and to him important executive orders that were then slowed or thwarted or blocked altogether by district and circuit courts, and he respected that. I think we need to be vigilant in watching closely to make sure that the Trump administration respects the rule of law, respects the separation of powers, and understands and embraces the fact that to the extent American democracy teaches to the world how we resolve conflicts peaceably and respectfully, given our constitutional order, that we must insist on his maintaining that most central underpinning of our constitutional order.
So, Senator, you mentioned earlier Senators Graham and Whitehouse teaming up on Russia hacking investigation. In addition, Senator McCain is certainly committed to it on the Armed Services Committee. I'm interested in the question from your perspective of how confident you are that the Senate institutionally is committed to fully investigating what happened during the last election and what ongoing Russian interference there may be in Western European democratic politics and in our own democratic politics into the future. Is this something that you look around a Republican-controlled Senate and say, you know, whatever our political disagreements, my colleagues are behaving like patriots here, and I'm confident we'll do everything the Senate needs to do or could reasonably do to get to the bottom of what happened? Or do you look around and you say, I have anxieties about whether the Senate institutionally is going to do everything that it needs to do?
I am very concerned about this for two reasons. One is, as I've already mentioned, the blizzard of activity by the early Trump administration is distracting. Senators, both supporters of President Trump and his opponents, have been careening between different Senate confirmations, challenges through executive orders, marches and rallies, interviews. And so I am concerned that there is already a diminution of focus on what is one of the most important strategic developments of recent years. The idea that our adversary, Russia, intentionally undermined our presidential election with a concerted campaign of cyber attacks, disinformation, strategically timed news releases, and that that was done with approval at the highest levels in Russia with the intention to affect the outcome, should itself be alarming enough, should itself be enough to have mobilized hearings in every relevant committee. There are hearings in both the Intelligence Committee and the Judiciary Subcommittee I referenced before. But the Foreign Relations Committee has still not taken it up. Armed Services, I think, has not done as much as it should. And there are other committees where I think this could also be relevant. The far more alarming allegation that there was actual coordination between the Trump campaign and Russia in this effort to change the outcome of the presidential campaign should be chilling enough to mobilize every senator, at least to question what we need to do to secure our future elections, if not to review the consequences of our most recent election. Being a democracy where free, fair, and regular elections can be counted on as a bedrock of our system is definitional for who we are as a republic. And that we seem to have moved past this point, partly because of the blizzard of recent news developments, and partly, frankly, because of the partisan lens with which this issue is being seen, gravely concerns me. And if the chair and ranking Senators Burr and Senator Warner on the Intelligence Committee had not come to an agreement to proceed with an investigation, I, for one, would have been jumping up and down on the Senate floor demanding it. I hope that we do not lose focus on the importance and the centrality of getting to the bottom of this, of taking appropriate remedial action, and of showing the world that even in a divided partisan period, we can act in concert in a way that is designed to repair this breach in the wall that is our democracy and our tradition of free and fair elections.
Thank you, Senator Coons. If I may, this is Tamara. Just one last question about a subject that I know is dear to your heart. I believe you're a former Peace Corps volunteer, and you've paid a lot of attention to development issues over the course of your time in the Senate so far. One thing that we know this administration is bent on is sending up a very slim budget to Congress for consideration. And you also have a continuing resolution that runs out April 28th. And the administration has already put on the table the need to pay for a wall between the U.S. and Mexico, a desire for increased military spending, all of this putting a lot of pressure on the budget. Those of us who work these issues are hearing panicked rumors about cuts to the Function 150 account, the foreign assistance programs of the State Department and USAID. And I wonder what you see forthcoming in terms of foreign aid, and how strong is the consensus in the authorizing committee, your committee, and in the Appropriations Committee for keeping that $54 billion in the foreign assistance account?
Billion, yes. Well, Tamara, that is a serious concern, I think, for all of us. The 150 account, the accounts out of which we fund development and assistance relief work around the world, was already under significant pressure. As you know, I'm a member of the Appropriations Committee. I'm a member of the subcommittee responsible for state and foreign operations, and that's where the 150 account gets its funding. The Foreign Relations Committee, which is the authorizing committee, has been less active in this area, but the Appropriations Committee has had to act on it directly each of the years that I've served on appropriations. There are obvious big challenges in the gap that you identified between President Trump's rhetoric on the campaign trail, his early promises as president, and budget reality. And it is striking that he's chosen as his director of OMB, someone who is what I'd call a budget radical, someone who literally was willing to vote to shut the government down, has rarely, if ever, voted for a budget, and who has views on how to slash federal spending that are pretty concerning. So there was already reason to be worried about the 150 account under sequestration, and in the last administration. In this administration, I think it's going to be under real pressure. I am grateful that Lindsey Graham, Senator of South Carolina, who chairs the State Foreign Ops Appropriations Subcommittee, is as positive and engaged and clear-eyed about the value of development assistance and diplomacy and relief as he is. Lindsey, Senator Graham, sees the impact on fragile and failed states of our investment and sees our national security as being advanced not just by military action, but by effective, transparent, and responsible investment in development. It is my hope that Congressman Hal Rogers on the House side, who is the corresponding Appropriations Subcommittee Chair, will also take the same direction. Kay Granger, Congresswoman of Texas, was his predecessor, and she was frankly terrific on this. We have a whole generation of military leaders who have testified in front of Appropriations and Foreign Relations who've said their experiences in Iraq and Afghanistan clarified for them how central to our security it is that we have effective development and assistance programs. And it is my hope that bipartisan work by Republicans and Democrats, and that a clear, strong voice on this by Secretary Mattis and Secretary Tillerson will carry us through. In my meetings with now Secretary Tillerson privately before his confirmation hearing and in the confirmation hearing, I pressed him on his understanding of the importance of the non-military components of security, the diplomacy and development components of security, and I was encouraged by his answers. And I'm confident that Secretary Mattis has the same view. So hopefully their voices, when combined with bipartisan voices in the Senate, will sustain the 150 account, will sustain the account through which we fund development and diplomacy, even in very difficult budget headwinds.
Well, Senator, thank you very much for joining us on the podcast. Thank you for giving us some reasons for optimism. It's nice to have. We've been in short supply lately. It was really great talking with you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate the invitation. Look forward to being on with you again.
All right. That went well.
Yeah, it was good. It was interesting.
He made some news.
I think he made some news. He faced a direct question of whether he had confidence in his colleagues that they would fully get to the bottom and to the Senate's ability of the Russian hacking stuff. And he said he had grave concerns on that score. And I think that's a remarkable statement.
Well, I also think, I mean, there was a question of, you know, how sincere do you think they are in their intention to investigate this on the Republican side of the Senate? But I think he also made the point that there's just so much coming at them up there, and they are only 100 mostly guys, that, you know, he said they're distracted. And that's kind of an understandable problem. How do you maintain momentum on this? But
he expressed concerns on both points. Yeah. He said, you know, there's the drinking from the higher fire hose problem, but there's also the partisan problem.
I mean, look, I think it speaks to sort of the sad state of current affairs, right? That the Republicans have for the past 2 weeks, as we've seen sort of assault after assault on some really pretty basic norms, the independence of the judiciary, ethics rules, right, sort of across the spectrum. We haven't seen a lot of statements or objections coming from that that party in Congress. And, you know, I think it's reasonable for their Democratic colleagues to sort of look at them and say, you know, I'm surprised here. I'm maybe reevaluating some of my assumptions about your commitments to some of the same things that I'm committed to and that I thought we agreed on before.
Yeah, well, go ahead, Tamara.
Well, I was going to say so much of, you know, these relationships in the Senate and decisions that senators make on these issues is about, well, one day the shoe might be on the other foot. And, you know, we've seen that with the filibuster rule. We've seen it with judicial nominations. And this is a case where it's quite clear that if there's not sufficient investigation and understanding of the nature of the problem and, you know, an effort to come up with new tools to defend against it, it next time it could be the Republican Party that suffers from this rather than the Democratic Party. It could be any one of these individual senators who finds themselves targeted. And so it is a sort of there but for the grace of God go I issue. And it's surprising that that doesn't get more traction.
And he did mention McCain and Senator Graham as being people who obviously have been on the side of pushing the Russia investigation. I mean, there seems to be like this, I don't want to say it's kind of growing sort of, you know, caucus within the Republican Party or group that's sitting in opposition to the president. But McCain, Graham, Sasse, Collins, there are probably a few in there, right, who are not necessarily just dependable, go along with whatever the White House says, partisans. So it seems like that's probably where, you know, Coons and Democrats are clearly trying to make some alliances. And he, you know, enumerated a few of those. So we'll see if those actually pay off.
I think the other thing that came through in his comments is the extent to which pre-existing relationships across the aisle are coming into play in this moment of greater challenge. So, you know, the Senate is a smaller body, but he talked about traveling with his Republican colleagues and kind of agreeing on certain common interests or common passions, even that they, you know, in the face of these new circumstances, it sort of tests those relationships, but at least they've got the relationships.
One thing I thought was sort of an interesting reminder, and in some ways just a really nice reminder, that, you know, Congress and the Senate in particular doesn't just exist as a reactive body to the White House, right? Their role is not just to sort of be partisan hacks. They actually have substantive agendas, right? Personal things that they care about, whether it's foreign policy or national security or tax reform or sort of you name it. What it's going to look like over the next 4 or 8 years as the Senate and individual senators work to accomplish that agenda and carry out sort of their vision and what they think their constituents elected them to do, and how that interacts with, you know, a president who is constantly creating sources of distraction, right? He talked about, hey, you know, Trump has created a lot of work. You know, there's already, it's already difficult. Time is kind of the most limited resource in the Senate. And if they're spending a lot of time working on sort of reacting to whatever crazy tweet he's done, that's going to make it really hard to accomplish an agenda that I think it's fair to say that both Republicans and Democrats actually really care about.
Can I tell you the question that, or the answer that I actually found the most distressing was the one where I teed up expecting him to say, no, you're being ridiculous. Of what happens if Trump just says, take your judicial order and shove it, basically. And he said, no, actually, I have a lot of concern about what might happen, that he might actually do that. I mean, this is not, you know, this is a rational person. That's why we had him on the podcast. I mean, to hear a senator say that and to hearken back to Andrew Jackson, and I have to imagine that that he is not unique in feeling this anxiety.
Well, Andrew Jackson, right, a portrait of whom now hangs in the Oval Office, right? Yeah.
That was sobering for sure.
There were a bunch of sobering moments in that conversation, even if Senator Coons is wrong in his anxiety on all of those points. The fact that a non-shrill, sober, responsible senator
feels that anxiety and it publicly expresses that anxiety is itself a probative of something about the atmosphere that we're in. Mind you, I don't think he's being alarmist or unreasonable to be concerned on those before. But even, you know, even if he's wrong in every particular, the fact that he feels that way is itself significant.
You know, I think too, though, he emphasized that the Senate has an independent role in foreign policy and national security, and that in a sense, the nature of what he's seen from the Trump administration so far seems to have spurred not only the Democratic side of the aisle, but also some Republican senators that he named to play a more active role as diplomats. And, you know, while acknowledging as he did the limits of that role, it's I expect that we're going to see a lot more of this, not just calls to the Australian ambassador sort of cleaning up after the horse, which are unfortunate, but perhaps useful or even necessary. But I think we may see senators in particular traveling more globally, meeting more with foreign leaders, expressing their own sense of American interests and American policy and their own trajectory, their own agenda, so that regardless of what the White House may say or do, there is another platform, another branch of government that is speaking on behalf of the United States to foreign officials. And I think we're going to see a lot more of that. And I also think it's an important thing to see at a moment when there's so much uncertainty around the world about where America stands on key issues of concern, about whether America is a reliable partner. It's not just reassurance, which is what Senator Coons mentioned, but there's actually an alternative foreign policy center in the system.
I just want to say that I, too, did my part to clean up after the president's horse on the Australia thing. I called the prime minister.
Oh, good.
And I reassured
him. I'm sure he
was
very glad to hear from you.
Independent
Republic of Lawfare.
Exactly.
Of course,
on behalf of the Independent Republic of Lawfare. I also tweeted under the notes from under Trump hashtag that.
Which is excellent, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
I'm enjoying that.
I tweeted that I was accepting nominations for the name of the first Australia-American war.
I'm not sure that's reassuring, Ben.
I got a huge number of great submissions, but the runaway winner was that's not a knife. This is a knife war.
It's a Crocodile Dundee.
You know, I have to say that the plethora of Crocodile Dundee references over this incident just killed me. It made me feel so old.
It also reminds me that my entire understanding of Australia was and probably largely has been informed by the Crocodile Dundee movies. I mean, I've read a lot since then.
Our cultural touchstone.
It kind of stuck, though. Yeah, it really is. It really is.
So I was actually substantively reassured even by the comments of, I agree. It's sort of right. It's alarming to hear a senator say, I don't know that the president of the United States will accept a judicial
decree. We're all gonna die.
That itself is an alarming statement. I was actually really reassured to hear Senator Coons make it because I think it represents a strategic shift and a shift that's necessary. And that's members of Congress not having any sense of naivete and really understanding that the President of the United States does not is not entitled to the presumption of good faith or the presumption of adherence to some of the same norms or rule of law principles that all of the rest of us agree to. And that if we don't sort of shift into being concerned, right, and sort of acknowledging that some of our basic assumptions about the commitments of White Houses, you know, of any party may be changed under this administration. And so in order to have a clear-eyed, effective response, either in constraining or directing or, cleaning up after what comes out of the White House, it's going to have to start with, a clear-eyed understanding that there are no rules anymore, potentially, or that there'll only be rules if we insist on them.
Right. So it adds a dimension to congressional oversight, for sure. And the fact that in the midst of that reality, Senator Coons was able to maintain his faith in some degree of bipartisanship in that project,
I personally found very helpful. So go clear-eyed bipartisanship.
Yeah, it's been maybe a good week for that. We'll see. Okay, let's move on to object lessons. Ben.
Well, my object lesson is a taco bowl.
Did you bring one to share?
I did not.
They make the best ones in Trump Tower.
No, they don't. So I walked into Susan's office yesterday, and there was a large taco bowl sitting on her desk.
It was Taco Tuesday.
And I'm so hungry. And there was a window in back of her, which looked out over the cityscape. And I looked at it, and it just reminded me of something. So I told her that she needed to lean over the taco bowl while I snapped a picture of her and give an inane grin, which she gamely did. And then she tweeted out,
did she
the
put
best
this
taco
on?
Bowls are made in the Brookings Inst cafeteria. I love Hispanics.
Oh, my God. And Susan.
And the Twitter reaction to this has been just one of the great things that has happened since the advent
of the Trump administration. Percentage of replies did not get the reference?
That's surprising. So first we should note for any listeners that do not get the reference, that is a direct quote, except for the Brookings Institution substitution for Trump Tower, of an actual tweet that the President of the United States actually tweeted while he was campaigning. And so actually some of the, a lot of people obviously understood the reference, but a number of people didn't, right? They were sort of responded like, that's so racist, what's wrong with you? And then whenever I replied by just replied by linking to Trump's original tweet, the response was just like, oh my God, he said that, right?
It's like, who missed this?
It's a, I don't know.
Was,
a lot of people
it was
on Twitter
only last
it.
Cinco de Mayo, right?
Oh my God.
So the best,
been so long ago?
The best single response
never
was,
forget the taco bowl.
The best single response was, I am a taco bowl and I find this really offensive.
Thank God some people on Twitter still have a sense of humor.
Oh my God.
Anyway, so Ben dared me. Please do not. Please direct all outrage to him and not to me.
Yeah, that's why it's my object lesson and
exactly.
Not Susan's.
Well done. All right, Susan, you do have an object lesson.
I have an object lesson. And it's either an omen or good fortune. And you have to, I need you all
Couldn't
to decide.
Couldn't it be a good omen?
Sure. Okay. Yeah, it could be a good. It's either it's an omen. It's a right. It's a good omen or a bad omen.
Gotcha.
So we had a mouse in the house. And before you get like think I like live in squalor or something. We live in like a 100-year-old DC
row
house.
No, you live in the city. It's good you didn't have a rat in the house.
Yeah, no. It was a little mouse. And it's really really hard during the winter to like find every single little hole. It's been a quite an adventure. I really do not like mice, neither does my spouse. so we've been setting traps like frantically. Because we hadn't seen the mouse. We just like, you know, there was evidence, right? A little hole chewed here. Right. And so this very clever mouse, we thought, was managing to like steal the food off the traps without getting caught in them, right? Because we were using these like
dastardly
very...
mouse.
It was like, right. And then the use of the traps were all single use. So he was like actually wasting my money, like destroying the traps. And so, like, this, so yes, Quinta knows bastard. Because I've been complaining about this for like 5 or 6 days now. This mouse has been my nemesis, right? So, we decided to go to war with the mouse and get the old-fashioned snap traps, right? And so we were sitting downstairs watching TV, and all of a sudden we heard a very loud snap. So we looked at each other and thought, okay, we've got the mouse. So we, my husband, the braver of the two of us, went to check the trap. It wasn't a mouse. It was two mice. Double mice in a mouse trap.
They must have been using teamwork to steal the food from the other mousetrap.
I took it as like a sign we're going to die, right? Of the apocalypse. My
the
husband
mice
thinks,
are getting smarter.
Yeah, the second mouse.
One
planet of the mice.
Oh, my husband thinks that one, it's like a good sign. Like it's like it's a blessing.
Yeah, to killing two birds with one stone.
It's like the loaves and fishes of mousetraps. He also suggested that it was romantic.
Because they died together?
Isn't it Romeo and Juliet?
Anyway, so I'd be
they
interested.
Were dead.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. They were dead. I'd be interested to know who votes that this is. a good sign of Hennessy family fortune and who thinks it's...
Rational Security will put up a Twitter poll on this question so that you can vote.
No, dude. You're living in a house full of dead mice. That's not a good thing.
Susan, I'll just say this, and I'm sorry to say it, but if there were two... There are many more.
No, there's been a very thorough inspection, including by a pest specialist. Oh, don't you worry. We are all over it.
Mice's days are numbered, clearly, because you have weapons of mouse destruction.
Mice, you're on notice.
The mice are on notice.
Ronnie and mice.
I'm coming for you two at a time.
Two at a time. No prisoners. All right. Well, that brings us to the end of a very special episode of Rational Security. Rational Security is, of course, produced by Spaghetti on the Wall Productions. You can find our show archive at spaghettionthewallproductions.com. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at RATLSecurity. Send us your greatest, bestest taco bowls, mouse traps. Build a better mouse trap.
Send us your questions, actually, because we're going to be doing, by reader request, we're going to be doing a Q&A session in the coming weeks. So tweet questions
at Rational Security,
at RATL.
Yeah, do
Security.
It.
Security.
Hit us up.
And send us your senators. We love senators.
Yeah. Call your senator.
Call your senators and ask them to be on this show, or if they know any sponsors. If you have a friend who's a senator who also has a friend at Harry's Razors, like, put it together, people.
And by the way, Lindsey Graham, come on the show.
Come on.
Because you really need to do Rational Security.
You really need to come on. We'll even come to you. Like, we'll make it happen. And if you're Lindsey Graham or anyone else and you happen to be downloading the podcast, please give it a rating and a review. We would really appreciate it. Our audio engineer is Quinta Jurassic. Our producer and editor is Jen Howell. Our music was performed this week by Chris Coons and the Sober Senators.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, I think it was, actually.
That's good. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You could do that band. Or should we like Chris Coons and the Kitty Cats, the Kit Kat?
No, the Sober Senators.
Sober Senators? Yeah. I like the alliteration. Yeah, double alliteration. And if they did have that band, you know who'd be backing them up on keys, obviously. Sophia Yan. On behalf of my good friends, Ben Wittes, Tamara Kaufman Wittes, and Susan Hennessy, and with special thanks to Senator Coons, I am Shane Harris, and we will talk to you next week. Thanks for listening.